learning more about the nature of the mind through a combination of analysis and contemplation and observation, coupled with meditation. And, of course, meditation is all about learning about your mind through direct observation and experience. And so these are two complementary things here. We had started out, I think the question that got us going was, what is concentration? And I was just wondering if any of you who were here for that discussion remember where that led to. And would be willing to try to express that. When we concentrate, what is concentration? What are we concentrating? Actually, we can even take a completely new take on that. If it's somebody who wasn't here that just wants to try out their understanding of what it is that we're doing when we say that we're cultivating concentration. Yes?
Focusing thoughts.
The focusing part, definitely. But let's look at the thought part. Now, in meditation, is our goal and intention to think?
No.
Not really, no. But if we have a skill in concentration, thought is definitely something we can apply it to. Okay? We can think something through. We can do an analytical meditation. We can carry out a contemplation by taking a particular topic or subject and thinking it through very carefully and very thoroughly. And the only way that we can do that is if we have the ability to keep our mind on track. So concentration can't be applied to thought. Concentration is more general than thought. So the focusing part, I agree with you. Concentration has an important element of concentration is focusing.
I think we talked about focused attention.
Attention, yes. That's what we talked about. When we thought about it, whatever it is that we're focusing, it seems to be the same thing that we refer to when we say attention. You pay attention to something, or you attend to something. And concentration seems to be about gaining some intentional control and achieving some stability of attention. Right? So, yeah. Learning some skills to do with attention. As a matter of fact, I think that we could sort of sum up what reference to concentration is by saying that it is learning to achieve stability of attention. And if we compare that to our normal situation, attention seems to be constantly moving around. It's very unstable. And when you were a child or a student in school, you had to learn to concentrate on your schoolwork, meaning you had to learn to keep your attention focused on subject matter at hand. And the mind didn't want to do that. The attention kept wanting to grow things, other things that were more interesting and exciting than, grammar or algebra or something like that. So, yeah, that's what we're doing when we meditate. We're training attention. And what are the qualities of attention? We talked about some of the qualities of attention I was wondering if some of the people that were here for that discussion would like to add that to this summary, or if anyone else would like to volunteer, what are the significant aspects or qualities of attention you think that we need to examine or truly understand it? Beth?
Well, I wasn't here before, but I keep getting this picture in my mind of sort of a focus, and all these things are coming from all over the place trying to break into it.
Yeah, that's right.
And usually they do, mm-hmm. you know, but the real attention would be when they just sort of, I don't know what, gently bounce off or something. You weren't even aware that they were there.
Just, yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's what we experience, isn't it? We try to pay attention to this, and all this other stuff keeps yeah. coming and competing for attention. Either to share the attentional space, or else to grab hold of the attention and take it away. Yeah. That's definitely one aspect of it. Yeah. Any others? Yes?
That it's directed and it's sustained? Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, well, that's actually the classical terminology that dates back to the Buddha himself applied to this, is that you're learning to direct attention and sustain attention. And in this way, intention is an important word to introduce in here. Because there's, when attention can be intentionally directed, you can direct it towards something that you have formulated an intention to pay attention to. But attention also moves spontaneously, right? So direction has to do with the movement of attention. If attention moves, then you have to redirect it back to what you intend to. And it tends to move. And you have to keep redirecting it. So that's a kind of a skill. And we all start out capable of directing attention. But it's not a skill that many of us have cultivated to a great degree, so that we direct our attention and it bounces away almost as fast as we direct it. Another part of it is to sustain our attention. You place your attention on something, and it stays there for a while, but then it's gone again. And so in the... If we go back to the oldest teachings on meditation, we find them talking about developing directed and sustained attention. And, you know, for me, I do have a background as a neuroscientist, and when I think of the mind, I can't help but think of it in terms of the activities of the brain, the functions of the brain that underlie it. To me, it seems to me that there is some part of our brain that, when we think of it as a mind, we can say a process of the mind that corresponds to a part of the brain, its main function is to direct the attention. And that can be either under intentional control, or else it's happening under the influence of some automatic processes. And most of the time, it's the automatic processes. And then there's another part of your brain, mind, that seems to have the function of deciding when you've paid attention to something long enough. So that you pay attention to something and your mind rests on that. And then a point comes where your mind is cut loose and your attention goes to something else. So there seems to be a part of the mind that has this function of determining when attention's been sustained on one thing long enough. And when I think about it, I think about consciousness, attention is to be conscious of something, right? You pay attention to something, you're conscious of it. And one of the things that we talked about was that we seem to have a limited capacity for conscious awareness. And conscious awareness does seem to be important. And so it makes sense that there would be some mechanism to make sure that this resource, mental resource we have, that exists and that has a limited capacity, gets used, gets applied in the best possible way. Right? So, and we all know if you absent-mindedness, your attention becomes too focused on one thing for too long, and the tea kettle goes dry and the kitchen catches fire and the house burns down, right? Or, you know, think of any example you want, but absent-mindedness. Whereas it's what actually happens with most of us in our life is our attention stays on any one thing as long as it seems to be sufficiently important. And then it's cut loose, and what happens then is attention seems to move from one thing to another, looking for something important that you should pay attention to. Or conversely, you're paying attention to something, and something more important comes along, and that's what you're talking about. It says, hey, pay attention to this. This is important. But the ability to sustain attention is something that we can train ourselves to do. It seems to be a mechanism that exists. It's there. It serves a purpose. And so we can take advantage of it and train it, if it is to our advantage, to be able to sustain our attention on something. Which, of course, is exactly what happens when we learn to concentrate as students in school or as meditators. Different kinds of things for different reasons, but it's the same thing. You're saying, okay, there's a benefit to be gained by being able to sustain the attention. So we have the intentional direction of attention as opposed to the spontaneous movement of attention in search of whatever is important or interesting. And then we have the sustained attention, which keeps the attention resting on the same thing. And, of course, when sustained attention gives way, attention moves, then we get to redirect our attention. In meditation, we do this over and over again until at some point the mind starts to respond really well. So that as long as you hold the intention, even if the mind moves away, it comes back automatically by itself. Every time it drifts away, it keeps coming back. Whatever. You could say, oh, I've trained myself in directed attention. Likewise, sustained attention. Every time you bring your attention back, you have the intention to remain with that for as long as you can. And sure enough, over time, it gets longer and longer, and you're able to stay there. So yes, intention, attention has these qualities. Focus. When you focus your attention on something, is that the only thing that you're consciously aware of? No. You're aware of other things simultaneously. What are you most clearly aware of? The focal point of your attention or the stuff in the periphery? What's at the focal point? If you're paying attention to two things at once, is the consciousness of the two things usually as strong, as clear as it would be if you were focusing on just one? No. That's true. So, and the thing that keeps coming up in here is consciousness, conscious awareness. And one of the other distinctions that I made last time is about how can we go about thinking in a productive way about the fact that there is a kind of awareness of many different things at any given moment. But there's something very special about some of those things in terms of the vividness and the clarity with which we perceive them. does that not correspond to the word we usually use when we say, I'm very conscious of the things? You're very conscious of something. So what you're most conscious of is what's at the focal point of your attention. What you're less conscious of are those things that are more in the more peripherally in the scope of your attention, right? But are there not also things that you are aware of in a sense, but you can't really say you're conscious of? Would you agree with that? And just to illustrate that, right now, examine the sensations in your left big toe. And when I say that, you shift your attention there, right? And you become more fully conscious of those sensations. And were you conscious of those sensations before I suggested it to you? No? No? Would you agree? Now, some of you might have been a little bit conscious of them, especially if your big toe ached or itched or something. But this is what I'm talking about. There are a lot of things that they're not totally out of the picture, you know, like whatever it is that's behind my head visually. You know, I have absolutely no visual awareness of the things behind my head at all. But there are things in my visual field that I have awareness of, but I may not actually be conscious of unless something draws focus of my attention to them. Right. Okay. That's the point I'm making. So, you know, I've struggled with finding the right words to talk about this and describe this, and settled on the basis of the way we normally use words in the English language, that in general, we are prone to use consciousness in a very specific way. And to say that we're conscious of something, or refer, when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about where there's a large degree of this illuminating quality of mind on the things that we're conscious of. Do you agree with that? And we tend to use awareness often in the same way, but we will also use awareness in ways that are more general. So what I propose to do is in order to describe what actually happens in our experience, is to appropriate the word awareness to say anything that registers on the mind or the nervous system in such a way that it's capable of producing a response or a reaction. Let's call that awareness, okay? And let's reserve consciousness for that difficult to define but very familiar quality of illumination, of knowing. When we're conscious of something, we have the experience of knowing it. Okay? Now the reason I want to do this is bring it to your attention and cause you to think about this. Take it back to attention. We can think of attention as having a focal point, and then there being a scope of attention. Even while in a particular moment, you're focused on one particular thing, conscious awareness, while focused on that, conscious awareness also is taking in a broader range of phenomena. And some things are further from the focus of attention than others, and the power of conscious awareness is decreased the further it gets from it. And that in fact there are a huge amount of things that we have some sort of subliminal or subconscious awareness of, but they're not really within the scope of our attention. And if we choose to use these two words a little more strictly in the way I'm suggesting, we would say there's a vast amount that we have an awareness of at a subliminal or subconscious level, but we're not consciously aware of it in the moment. Does that agree with your experience? So this attention that we're talking about then, now what we've done is we've created a very powerful link between this stuff we call consciousness and this phenomenon that we were referring to as attention. Okay? So attention has all to do with consciousness, conscious awareness. Out of all the awareness, attention is that part of all of your awareness that is conscious. And the focal point of the focus of your attention is that of which you're most fully conscious. So concentration then has to do with attention, and now we brought it around to consciousness. Concentration has to do with conscious awareness. And if we go back to looking at the way attention behaves, let's picture attention like the spread of a beam of light, and it has a focal point in the center. Right? So we have this beam of mental illumination we call consciousness, like a physical light beam. And we can move it around. And you can be conscious of your big toe, and you can be conscious of the back of your hand, and you can be conscious of what you're looking at, and you can be conscious of the sound of the fan. You can move it around. And then putting the focal point on different things. And as you move the focal point, what's in the periphery of your consciousness tends to change as well. Right? And then, as we saw earlier, this attention, this being of mental illumination, things can invade it, jump into it. Or things can sort of grab it back here by the handle and redirect it, right? And so when we meditate and we're trying to work consciously and intentionally, that's an interesting thing I just said that I'll come back to, work consciously with it. We work intentionally with our attention. What we do at some point is we realize that, well, I have to be aware when something is creeping in there and going to become the focal point of my attention. And I have to become aware when something is starting to manipulate the handle of the spotlight of consciousness and redirect it somewhere else. If I can do that, then I can use my skill and directed attention to refocus my conscious awareness where I choose. If I become aware of that, I realize that the drift is starting to happen. Not only can I, if it's already happened, can I bring it back? But if I can sense that it's about to happen, I can keep it from happening. I can somehow exert an intentional influence over that sustaining, that tension-sustaining part of my mind to say, hey, don't let it go. Stay on this one. So these are some of the different qualities that attention has in terms of consciousness. Attention is movable, but the scope of attention is invadable. Another thing about the scope of attention that you will have noticed, I'm sure, is that it can be expanded or it can be contracted, right? You can focus your attention very tightly on something. This is where all of your conscious awareness is. And very little else is included in there. You're not conscious of very much else. But other times you can expand it. You can open up. You can let it take in so much more, right? Or anywhere in between these two. You know, we learn to do that in order to multitask, try to keep track of more than one thing at once. Sometimes we bounce around back and forth, sometimes we just expand the scope of attention. An interesting thing that we've already alluded to, though, whenever you expand the scope of your attention, what happens to the quality of the conscious awareness of the specifics within that scope?
It's not as intense.
What?
It's not as intense.
It's not as intense. Yes, it loses intensity. It loses clarity. It's definitely diminished. So, in that way, it's a lot like a physical light beam, too. You know, you take your flashlight and you turn the lens and spread the beam, and a whole lot more is illuminated, but not as brightly. But you can turn it the other way, and now you can't see anything but what's right there, right in front of you, but it's very brightly done. The other thing, though, now this is something that you may have noticed, but you may not have, but this is very important in terms of meditation, and that is that you can crank up the power of conscious awareness. Just like, you know, you have this light, and you can spread the beam or you can focus it in. Imagine you've got this little dial. You can dial it up so that, say you had it focused on something this big in front of you, and you could see it brightly and clearly, and then you spread it out, and everything starts to get vague, and then you go back here and you crank up the dial, and now that whole area, everything in it, is just as bright as what was right in the center before. And this is a very important thing that you can accomplish in meditation, and you want to be able to accomplish in meditation. You not only gain control over the movement of attention, gain control over the scope of the attention, but you can also gain control over the power of the conscious awareness that is what is illuminated by attention. And we have a word for that too that once again comes from the ancient Pali sutras of the Buddhist teaching. And it's called it's usually translated into English as mindfulness. Far better would be translated into something like the power of conscious awareness or the power of mindful awareness. Because if you followed what I've said so far, you see how that's a much more accurate description of what we're doing. It's that power. Now, I should qualify that. In the Pali, we're very clear in the Buddhist teachings, the teachings of the Buddha himself were originally recorded first verbally and later in writing in a language called Pali, which was a formal version of the many different dialects spoken in the part of India where the Buddha lived and wandered and taught. And they're called the Magadhi dialects. And as it is in societies that have many different dialects, there usually comes to be a formal language that's understood by all of the people who cannot necessarily understand everything in each other's dialect. And so Pali was the formal language of that part of India. And there is the word sati, which we translate as mindfulness. And in the time of the Buddha meant very specifically this power of conscious awareness, the power of mindful awareness. Now there is another meaning, both in English and this time in Sanskrit, that I should tell you about so that you know you'll come across it so you won't be confused. A few centuries later, the Buddhist teachings were translated into Sanskrit, which had been the traditional language of spiritual teachings, the language of the Brahmins, for many, literally thousands of years before the time of the Buddha. And so a few centuries after the passing of the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings were translated into Sanskrit, And some of the words in Pali were Sanskritized, and so that version of Sanskrit is known as Buddhist Sanskrit. And in that Buddhist Sanskrit, there's a word corresponding to sati, but it took on a different meaning, more one of remembering. And so this is another way that you'll see the word translated into English as mindfulness used, is as though it's referring to remembering. And it's accurate. It's a very important part of what we need to do. I mean, when you meditate, you have to remember what you're doing, right? And how do you remember what you're doing in mindfulness or in meditation? It's because, or it happens because here I am focused on my meditation object, whether it's a breath or a visualized Buddha image or whatever it happens to be. I'm focused on my meditation object. And of course, what happens if I get too focused on my meditation object, my mind just does its ordinary thing, and at some point, the attention sustaining mechanism says, yeah, this is not important anymore, and it's gone somewhere else. But then you'll have this experience of remembering, realizing, oh, this, I didn't sit down here to think about the new car I wanted to buy. I sat down here to practice meditation. And so that is a kind of mindfulness. And what you do when you meditate is you learn to have some of your attention at all times directed towards the mind itself. Not directed outward towards a meditation object, but some of it directed inward towards what is the mind doing? And that's what allows you, you know, I talked about earlier when you're sitting there meditating and you realize that something is pulling your attention away, and so you redirect it back. Okay, that is mindful awareness. That is specifically mindful awareness. That is observing what's going on in your mind at the moment. And so it does involve a kind of remembering. So this other meaning of mindfulness as remembering is accurate. And understanding it is useful and important. But the original meaning of sati is very important. The power of mindful awareness, the power of consciousness. This is what you're increasing. This is a really important thing that you increase in meditation. If you don't do that, your meditation becomes an exercise in slipping into dullness. You're ignoring everything else. You're shutting down awareness of sensory stimuli. Your mind is ceasing to generate all of its thoughts and everything else. And if the power of conscious awareness is not increased, it's going to decrease, and you're going to end up sitting there in a trance-like state of dullness. But what's really interesting is if it increases, if your mind does become quiet, and the power of your mindfulness increases, and you're not paying attention to sensory stimuli, and your mind's not generating random thoughts about this, that, and the other thing, all the usual kind of mental clutter that you live with all the time. If it's not doing that, all of this mindful awareness is occupied with the mind itself. And so, when you're meditating, you learn that, well, the only way I can keep my mind in the meditation object is to notice when it's starting to drift, or to notice when something else is coming in, or to notice when I'm starting to get dull and dozy. So what happens there is you start off and you're looking at your meditation object, and then every now and then you turn around and look at yourself and say, oh yeah, okay, I'm still in the meditation object, good. Or you look at yourself and say, ooh, guess I lost it. But after a while you come to a place where instead of it being an either or, a back and a forth, I'm looking at my meditation object, now I'm looking at my mind, now I'm looking at my meditation object, and have a quick check-in on my mind and say, oh yeah, I'm still doing all right. But we'll come to a place where you're now always watching the mind, and the mind is still watching the meditation object. Right? So when that happens, and you have this power of mindful awareness, this power of mindful awareness is naturally focused on the mind. And then you are, at that point, beginning to fulfill the real goal of meditation in terms of coming to know and understand, see the nature of the mind itself. You started out, it was just a simple problem of how do I keep my mind on the object? And by step, it becomes powerful conscious awareness focused on the mind itself. And at that point, you don't even need the meditation object anymore. At that point, you can toss the meditation object overboard.
I say it, just your visual, how you were using your hand and your meditation objects somewhere other than in your mind. I think of it as the fusion of your meditation object is your mind. It's the fusion
yes.
of those two things. It's not something that's external or
yes.
down the road or something else.
That's very accurate, very perceptive. That is exactly what happens and exactly where you want to go. Because if you examine your experience, it starts out, if you're using the breath as a meditation object, then the sensations are happening out here where the awareness of them is in some difficult to identify, but in here space. Right? Even if your meditation object were, say you were visualizing a Buddha image, there still is that relationship of here and there in that. And what you're really moving to, and where you'll naturally and spontaneously reach, is the fusion of the two. And of course, that by itself is an insight. You realize that all these out there things are actually in the mind. They're all in here to start with. So, anyway. So, yes, where should we go from here? Is this interesting to you? And is this helping you in a positive way in terms of how you're going to be able to carry out your meditation practice? I think it's important to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. You know, I tell you, go rub these sticks together all afternoon until something happens, and then come back and tell me about it. And if you did do that, you'd eventually say, it started to smoke. Got hot. But it's better if I tell you what it is you're trying to do. This consciousness, it's a really interesting thing. Everything comes down to it in the end. Now we started talking about what is concentration, and we discovered it was all about consciousness. And the more we talked about it, the more we're seeing that everything is about consciousness. Attention is that, out of all the things that there is some kind of awareness of, attention, the scope of attention, the focus of attention, that's the scope and focus of conscious part of awareness. Let's look at the relationship between these two and see if we can gain any deeper understanding of consciousness itself. First of all, I want to remind you of all the experiences you've had of awareness allowing you to function in the world in very complex ways without any consciousness. You're aware of that, right? There are the classic and obvious examples of you driving a car, which is a very complex activity. But you can be talking to somebody or thinking about something, and you'll suddenly come into the present and realize you have no idea of anything that's happened in the last half hour. So it's really interesting. This non-conscious awareness is very effective and useful stuff. Some people researching in the area of cognitive science and philosophy of consciousness have raised the question, what is consciousness good for? Is it necessary? If you can drive a car across town without being conscious of it, Why are we conscious anyway?
Because you have to be conscious before you can be unconscious of it.
Now that is a very good point. You have to be conscious before you can be unconscious. Yeah. Yeah, because if you remember what it was like learning to drive a car, or if you remember what it was like the first time you drove through that neighborhood when it was a strange and foreign place, you were very conscious. So there is a role that consciousness plays. Once it's played its role, then things can happen unconsciously. How much of your life takes place unconsciously? A lot. A lot. And what things are your what kinds of things does your consciousness do? Like, are you totally unconscious, or is your consciousness doing something else while you're living your life unconsciously?
Usually doing something else.
Usually your consciousness is occupied with something else. Yeah, so your attention is somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. How important are most of the things that occupy your consciousness while you're living your life unconsciously?
Not very.
So, right away we can see that there's a tremendous scope here for making your life, at the very least, more interesting if you can change that state of affairs. Do you know what a zombie is? What's a zombie?
Automatically functioning.
Yeah, it's a kind of a thing out of superstitious folk beliefs where a dead body is animated and, you know, it can do things but nobody's home. Philosophers have raised the question of, you know, they've used the idea of a zombie, and they say, well, we can do all of these things and not be conscious of them. So theoretically, there could be a zombie who has all this automatic programming so that they can't, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell them from anybody else. Because just as when you're in zombie mode and the red light, brake lights come on the car in front of you, your foot moves to the brake and presses it down. You know, you come up to the zombie and say, what do you think is the meaning of life? And the zombie regurgitates a sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill, ordinary meaning of life answer, right? So how would you know they're a zombie? And if it's possible for there to be such a kind of zombie, then what is consciousness anyway? What's the difference between a conscious person and that kind of zombie?
There's a presence in the conscious person, right?
First of all, let's look at, is there any objective difference? I mean, by definition, there isn't, because we've already said, imagine a zombie that had all the programming so that you couldn't tell it apart. So we've already defined our zombie in such a way that objectively we can't tell a difference. So this consciousness, if one of these two beings in front of us is conscious, the only one that's going to know is the conscious being, because it's a subjective experience. Consciousness is that subjective experience. Very interesting.
So someone who is in a state of real consciousness, conscious awareness, is mm-hmm. one who knows that he knows.
Mm-hmm.
The thing right in front of you, you are focused on, you know that you're knowing. It's a very subtle thing to try to describe, but it's a presence. Mm-hmm. You're very present with what is in front of you or what you're focusing on.
Now, this is a really interesting thing. You use the word twice. Knows that he knows. Let's just see if that is absolutely essential. Or could the difference between a zombie and another person be the zombie doesn't know. The zombie just does. I mean, what do you, it really gets down to what you mean by know. Does your computer know your email address?
Yeah.
You would say yes, but you could also say no. You say computers don't know anything. It's just a mechanical kind of function.
That'd be the degree of consciousness? Degree?
Well, let's see if it takes us to degrees of consciousness. Yes.
You can ask the question between what's the difference between a zombie and a conscious person. I think of choice. The word choice comes to my mind. It's an exercise of choice. Your zombie is a responsive, reactive type of entity, whereas
yes,
a conscious person has some element of choice. You know, if you ask what color the sky is, the zombie will say blue, but a conscious person may say hues of purple, and this conscious person may say sky blue, or something. I mean, I think it's sort of an exercise of choice in your mind and in your awareness.
That's a very, very interesting and important point. But yes, there is some aspect of choice that we speak of a zombie. If we speak of a zombie, or if we speak of a computer, if we're speaking in these sorts of mechanistic terms, imagining that we have sophisticated programming skills, to create zombies or computers that would behave like human beings and things like that, it's still deterministic in a way that we don't consider ourselves to be, right? So there is a difference there. And that, as a matter of fact, that does fit with the very first thing that came up. We're conscious so that we can, because we have to be conscious before we can learn to do the things that we do automatically. Consciousness plays a role in creating the program. And a conscious being can alter the program. It has some element of choice there that is not, that's not implicit in our concept of a deterministic zombie. So that's a good point. And we'll get to levels of consciousness too. What is your comment that you were going to make?
Oh, me?
Yes.
Oh, I was just going to say it sort of brings us back to that point of intention, the word intention.
Intention.
To be able to have intention, choice, intention to be very.
Yes, right. Choice and intention. Because when we sit down to meditate, what happens is what our brain is already conditioned to automatically do. And we sit down with a different intention. And we exercise a kind of choice. And as a result of that, we can train our brain to operate in a different way in the future. And we can become a skilled meditator. But it's interesting, we brought ourselves to a whole new level, right? Intention. Choice.
Discernment.
What?
Discernment.
Discernment.
I think of that with choice.
Yeah. So, knowing, if we take the word knowing, I'll take you back to some, knowing and knowing that you know. Take you back to some of the Pali once again. The word for knowing or to know in Pali is jnana. Jnana. And in Sanskrit it's very similar to jnana. It's jnana. And there's two different kinds of knowing that are spoken of. There is dhyana, which is what you might call dualistic knowing or two-part knowing. There's the knower and the known. And then there is non-dual knowing, which is associated with something called wisdom or prajna. So, when you know that you know, who knows, who is it that is the knower and who is it that's the known? Are the knower and the known different?
No.
But if you know your telephone number, right? If you know your name, if you know the capital of Virginia, if you know left from right, this is all dualistic, isn't it? That if you know what I'm holding in my hands, there's two things. There's you, the knower, and there's the thing that's known. Vijnana. And I think we can, we're running out of time here, but if you were, but this will give you something to think about. I think that if you think about it, you'll come to the conclusion that this is an important distinction, because our zombie could know something. Okay? There's no reason why a brain and a mind arising out of the brain can't organize in such a way that it distinguishes between me, the knowing zombie, and the known cup, or the known fact, or the known experience, right? You follow what I'm saying? No? Follow? Yeah, maybe it's a big jump. What's that?
Are you getting to non-dualism?
I'm getting to non-dualism here. I'm getting to an aspect of consciousness that, a refinement of consciousness. Okay, maybe we should just, let's back up a little bit and just talk about how do we experience consciousness? I use the example of it as a mental illumination. Does that resonate? When you are conscious of something, it's as though that something is illuminated. Like it has a light shown on it, and you can see it. So, does your brain know what to do when the brake lights come on in the car ahead? Does your brain know how to interpret the sensations that are produced when you start to press on the brake? Is your brain capable of adjusting the pressure on the brake to produce the right rate of stopping? And can correlate that with how rapidly the tail lights are expanding in your visual field or not? If something unusual happens, can your non-conscious brain recognize that, oh, this is outside of the scope of the usual? This is something different. Well, if it can't, How come when you're completely lost in thought, if a child runs off the sidewalk, you immediately come into present awareness of what's happening in front of you? So what happened is, this was all in the dark. What was happening with the car in front and the traffic and everything else was all happening in some dark place. Whereas the light of consciousness was shining on something else. Your anger at yourself for not having the perfect comeback to the person that insulted you a half an hour. That's where the light of consciousness is. But all of a sudden it changes. And you can't say that it was the light of consciousness, but you can't say it was the attention that was focused on the mental processes that you were engaged in that became aware that something unusual requiring conscious attention had just arisen, right? Something that required a kind of decision making and choice, something that went beyond the automatic programming. So if it didn't come from the attention, where did it come from? It must have come from that unconscious awareness. So even that dark place carries out some fairly sophisticated judgments. Knows when it's time to go and grab the handle of the torch of consciousness and refocus it. So anyway, maybe it's too big a jump to ask you to think yet about the difference between knowing and knowing that you know. But you'll think about it anyway. I doubt if you can go away and not think about it anyway.
Can we think about it next week?
We can think about it week after next.
Oh, the week after.
Yeah. Unless Brian wants to think about it with you next week. Which he might. Yes.
Is there time for a question or not?
It's time for a question, yes.
This is going back a ways, but you're trying to focus your attention, and you accomplish that, and then another thought comes in. You're not aware of that right away, but after a while it's like, oh my gosh, how did I get to this point? It seems like there's almost like a battle that goes on. Rather than just it's like who can outsmart who.
Yeah.
Rather than just a sort of a calm, like, oh, you know, I'm focused on this, but this other thing wants to be there, so everybody's nice and kind and gentle. It's like, it seems like there's a battle, almost like there's two.
At least two.
Yeah.
At least two. Okay. Well, that's a very important thing. Okay. Let me point this out, because all of this will be a lot easier to think about and understand if you keep this in mind. Your mind is not one thing. Your mind is many different things. Doing different things, doing it for different reasons, with different goals.
Uh-huh.
So, one part of your mind sees its job as doing this for the sake of this, and it considers that to be really important. And another part of your mind considers its job to take care of this kind of business, and for this reason, and these are its goals and objectives, and it considers that to be paramount important.
Uh-huh.
And so do the other 600 processes that are going on in your mind. So you have at least a struggle between at least two different things.
Uh-huh.
And this also comes back to a very interesting thing, is they spend a lot of time jostling to see who gets the attention.
That's for sure.
What, you know, trying to, and really the role of the attention sustaining part of your mind is to decide when one mental process has had enough attention and it's time to let the attention go somewhere else. Let some other mental process have some attention, which works really well to your survival advantage. It makes sure that you pay attention to a lot of what's going on around and hopefully pick out the most important things and react and respond appropriately to them. Your mind is many different processes.
So I mean, there's some real competition, some serious...
Real competition,
yeah.
And an important part of this is all of these processes are unconscious unless the light of consciousness is shown upon them. And even there, you don't usually get that much illumination on the process itself.
No.
Only on the product of the process. Okay? Anyway. So, a little different perspective on meditation. So, when we meditate, we develop concentration, and we develop mindful awareness. And when your concentration reaches a certain strength, the power, the mind will unify and joy will arise. And when the mind gets used to being in this unified state, this joy will subside in intensity and you will begin to experience tranquility. The joy is still there, but now there's tranquility. And then, when the joy and tranquility are well established in your mind, then will come really well-developed equanimity, what we started out at the very beginning of the evening. You will have a mind that is in a state of joy. And in October, I'm going to talk to you all about what joy is, but here's the answer I'll give you. Joy is a state, a mental state. Okay? So you're in a state of joy. The mind is tranquil. It responds with equanimity. And it does so because it's unified, and it's become unified through the practice of concentration, gaining stability of attention. Now, the mindful awareness part of it, you won't be able to develop sufficient concentration for unification to take place and joy, tranquility, and equanimity to develop unless you've developed, at the same time, a power of mindful awareness. And not only that, you've learned to focus it on the mind itself so that it's a kind of introspective mindful awareness. So if you do that, then you have a joyful, tranquil, equanimous mind with powerful conscious awareness focused on itself. And the result of that is insight. Liberating insight. And so that's the whole path that we're trying to tread here. And it begins with concentration and mindful awareness. So, now, within that whole structure, we started out with concentration. We talked about concentration as involving directed and sustained attention. And we talked about mindful awareness as being the power of consciousness, the illuminating power of consciousness. So I think maybe what we'll talk about next time, we'll continue from here, but what I think we need to give a little more attention to is the unification of mind. What that is, how it comes about, and yeah. Okay, good. So we have a program for our future talk. But thank you very much.
Thank you.